end of a Bible class quarter. So we are going to kind of wrap up our tour through the books of Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers. Numbers especially, we've just kind of had to pick and choose a few chapters just to, in the interest of time. So that's lesson 23 in your workbook. We're going to be looking at just several chapters toward the end of Numbers and looking at Israel's preparations for entering the land of Canaan at the close of that wilderness wandering that we've been talking about. I'm going to go ahead and, so that I don't forget to do this at the end, starting Sunday, we're going to be talking about the Gospel of Luke. We're going to spend one quarter going through the Gospel of Luke. If you do the math, that's a pretty fast pace. We've got 24 lessons next quarter, 24 class periods, and Luke has 24 chapters. So that's going to be one chapter per lesson, and Luke's got a lot in it. So we're going to be moving pretty quick through that. There are workbooks back in the back that is also available on the website. You got your choice of comb-bound or stapled or digital. Take your pick. And we'll start that with Luke chapter 1 on Sunday and work our way through that. And then next quarter, the summer quarter, we're going to follow that up with the book of Acts, which just picks right up where Luke leaves off, and do a quick tour through the book of Acts as well. That'll be back-to-back. So that's what's coming up. Again, if you haven't picked up those workbooks or downloaded one for your use, please be sure you grab that on your way out tonight. Numbers 26 is where I want us to begin tonight. Since in our study of Numbers, we've been having to kind of skip over a few things, let me just catch us up on the chapters that we are not covering tonight. A few things that you're just going to want to know what's there. In Numbers 28 and 29, there are various laws concerning kinds of offerings and sacrifices. We already talked about that at some length earlier in the quarter, and actually looked at a couple of things in Numbers 28 to supplement that. So it's just a little more detail on those things in those two chapters. Numbers 34 gives some instructions regarding the borders of the promised land that would be Israel's territory, and some of the very general instructions for how it was going to be apportioned. There are more specific instructions for that in the book of Deuteronomy. And then Numbers 36 just kind of wraps up with a case of, we'll just call it inheritance by marriage. That's usually the heading in our Bibles. What to do when there were intermarriages between the tribes, or circumstances like that as far as inheriting the allotment of property. Just some details about that in chapter 36. We're looking tonight at chapters 26 and 27, chapters 32 and 33. And chapter 35, and we'll stitch all of that together to talk about some important things in the events, and a couple of things that I think are going to be important for us to think about in preparation as the Israelites prepare for the occupation of Canaan. This section begins with the second census of the people. The first one was way back in chapter 1 when they were at the foot of Mount Sinai, camped out there. Now here we are nearly 40 years later, and in Numbers 26, there is another census of the people, another numbering of the people, and again, that's where this book gets its name, at least in our English versions, just asked about a couple of changes. Just compare the numbers between the first census and the second one a generation later. So in the second census, if you had time to look through these numbers, which of the tribes numbered the largest? All right, Judah did, 76,500. And these are, again, men of war over age 20, just like in the previous census. Which tribe numbered the smallest? All right, Simeon, what was 22,200. Not too surprisingly, Simeon is going to get a very small piece of territory that's actually kind of within the territory of Judah, and it ends up kind of getting absorbed by Judah along the way throughout Israel's history, because it just is so small relative to the other tribes. Compared to the census in chapter 1, which one of these tribes had seen the greatest increase in its number? Okay, that's what I came up with too. Manasseh, over 20,000 more than the census nearly 40 years prior. Which tribe had shrunk the most, seen the greatest decrease? Okay, Simeon had. I don't know what was going on with Simeon. I guess a lot of the people of Simeon, Simeon had a lot of people that were over the age in that first generation who perished. Maybe they perished early. But whatever the causes were, besides Moses, this is one of the important things. Besides Moses, how many of those men who had been numbered in the first census are also numbered in the second and will actually enter the land of Canaan? Okay, two. All right, verses 63 to 65 tell us. Now, that's really powerful. We're talking about 605,000 and plus, 605,000 and something that were numbered in that first census. They're all gone. They've been replaced by a new generation that's almost as numerous, 601,730. But that entire generation perished in the wilderness. How come Joshua and Caleb escaped that? Okay. All right, we always remember that. I mean, these are things we instill even in children's classes. These are the faithful spies who after they scouted out the land said, if God is pleased with us, He'll bring us into this land. Chris? Mm-hmm. Right. It is substantial. And same with Joshua. Joshua is, by our standards, an old man when he leads the Israelites in the conquest of Canaan, and a very old man when that conquest is finished and he bids them farewell. So, yeah, that's a good point. Why does God allow Moses to see Canaan but not enter it? Hasn't been very long since we talked about this. Okay, all right. It's because of the incident at Kadesh that we talked about in chapter 20, where the people wanted water, and Moses and Aaron both, in their frustration, said, listen now, you rebels, must we fetch water from you for you from this rock? And in addition, Moses was instructed to speak to the rock and instead struck it. And while that's technically a violation of what God had told him to do, the greater problem at work is Moses' failure to give God the credit for what was being done on that occasion. And because of that, Moses is not permitted to be the one who actually leads the people into Canaan. I hesitate to ask this because I don't want to go too far afield. Does that seem like a pretty extreme punishment for one transgression? Mike doesn't think so. Mike would have lowered the boom on him too, right? No. Why do you say no? Very good point. Yeah. Jeff? Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Good. Get it. Yeah. Right. Okay. Good observation as well, yes. So who takes Moses' place? I already gave this away, but okay. Joshua does, all right? In chapter 27. Yeah. Yeah, as old as Joshua is, he gets, yeah. Right. Yeah, okay. Remember, Joshua's been, he's been Moses' servant, his aide-de-camp, whatever you want to call it, for, you know, ever since they left Egypt, basically. You know, it's definitely a logical choice, but also because of Joshua's faithfulness in bringing back in his attitude along with Caleb when they came back from spying out the land. We studied Joshua not terribly long ago, and it kind of overlapped with this, talking about Joshua's being chosen to be Moses' replacement as the leader of Israel. Would you say Joshua did a good job with that charge from what you remember? Okay. Yeah. He did an outstanding job with that charge. Leading, you know, dealing with many of the same kinds of problems that Moses did on top of trying to manage a military invasion of the land of Canaan, even though God is directing that and interceding on Israel's behalf in so many ways. You know, Joshua's got a lot on his plate. Let's talk about anything else on those couple of chapters. We just picked a few high points from there. Any questions or comments or thoughts? So in chapter 32, we get to something that has the potential to be disruptive. This situation a couple of times in Israel's history has the potential to be really disruptive. The men of Reuben and Gad in particular come and make a request of Moses. This is chapter 32, the first few verses. What do they ask for? Okay, all right. Yeah, they say basically, you know, this land that we're in, verse 4, the land which the Lord conquered before the congregation of Israel, it's talking about the land east of the Jordan where they have already had some military victories. That land is a land for livestock, and your servants have livestock. If we have found favor in your sight, let this land be given to your servants as a possession. Do not take us across the Jordan. So they're talking about the territory, you know, that it's, you know, just barely on the map there, up at the top right corner, on the east side of the Jordan, and it actually extends up considerably further north than that. The region of Gilead, which you hear about often in both Old and New Testaments. Is kind of the northern part of that. You know, they're asking for a lot of elbow room, for sure. Why does Moses react badly to that at first? Is it understandable? I think it is. Go ahead. What's Moses' reaction? Anybody? Chris, you had it? Go ahead. Okay, yeah. Shall your brothers go to war while you yourselves sit here? Verse 6. And he sees this as, you know, as something and if they chose to do that, it'd be a huge discouragement to the other tribes. Everybody has gone through so much to get here, and now God's about to bring them into the land, and all of a sudden two of the tribes just want to bail? We're just going to take the land over here, and the rest of you get... That's what Moses thinks they're asking. And says, you know, this would be a great discouragement to the rest of the people. In fact, he says, you're going to discourage the people the same way your fathers did. Remember a couple of things. He's hearkening back to the 10 spies, because remember, the spy from Reuben and the spy from Gad were among the 10 who had brought back that negative report. No, the people are too big, the cities are too strong, we can't conquer the land, and he's saying you're acting just like they did, and you know you're gonna, you know, may you meet the same fate. And also I don't think Moses mentions it specifically here, but there was a strong contingent from the tribe of Reuben that was involved in the rebellion of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Korah was a Levite, but Dathan and Abiram were from the tribe of Reuben. Maybe there's a bad taste left over from that as well. But Moses gets some clarification from them. He says to them, if you turn away from following him, God will once more abandon them in the wilderness, and you will destroy all these people. So what did the men of Reuben and Gad promise they would do? Okay, that's it. They said, let us build sheepfolds for our livestock and cities to protect our families, and we'll cross the Jordan and fight the battles just like everybody else. And only when the land has been conquered will we return to our homes over here on this side of the river. We will not return to our homes until every one of the sons of Israel has possessed his inheritance, verse 18 says. And that finds favor in Moses' sight, and presumably, I think we're safe to say, in the sight of the Lord as well. But Moses says if they would do as they promised, they could possess the land that they asked for. If you will not do so, verse 23, what does he say will happen? This is one of my favorite verses. All right. Be sure your sin will find you out. Because you will have sinned against the Lord if you do that. People are going to know, God's going to know, you're not going to just be able to slink away and get away with it if you choose not to cross the river with the other tribes and participate. And who else, we find out down in verse 33 and in verses 39 to 42, who else gets territory on the east side of the Jordan along with Reuben and Gad? All right. Parts of the tribe of Manasseh, so we just call it half the tribe of Manasseh. So Manasseh will end up with territory on each side of the Jordan. Moses gives instruction to Eleazar about what the plan is, and he says if they fight, then return them here. And he says if not, they're going to get an inheritance on the west side of the Jordan. And the implication of that is it's not going to be very much. From what we know of the history of the conquest, the men of Reuben and Gad and Manasseh keep their promise. Later on, there's another potential problem that arises with these tribes when they build a memorial altar on their side of the Jordan in the book of Joshua. It's not an altar of worship to rival the tabernacle, but it was perceived that way initially. And Joshua and the rest of the people, what are you doing? Well, this is a memorial of God's goodness to us, and that was acceptable, but it had the potential to be disruptive until the men clarified their motives, kind of like here. All right. Chapter 33 got some instruction. It got a number of things in chapter 33. We're looking primarily at the end, because you kind of have in the first part of the chapter a review of the journey from Egypt to the banks of the Jordan, and a lot of the place names, many of which we just don't know specifically where they were. It talks a lot about that, but we're looking especially starting in verse 50, question number 6. What does God instruct the people? You probably know this without even having to look. What does God instruct them about the conquest of Canaan? What are they supposed to do? Okay, all right. Drive out the inhabitants. What else? All right. Destroy all their idols. The wood ones, the metal ones, the stone ones. Demolish the high places. These were places, and usually they were on hilltops, hence the name high places, but they were places that were set apart for worship of pagan deities, usually had an altar on them. drive the people out, smash their idols, remove their high places. Okay? Very simple instruction. Does this instruction get carried out fully from what you remember of the book of Joshua? It does not. He says in addition, verses 53 and 54, they must take possession of the land and maintain their family inheritances. Those, you know, two things go together. If they don't completely drive out the inhabitants, they're not going to fully maintain the tribal allotments that are given to them. What problems, and I know I'm asking you to just kind of reach back into your knowledge of Bible history and the book of Joshua and the book of Judges, for instance, but what problems arose from the Israelites failing to completely drive the inhabitants out? Okay. One big problem that the text highlights is they established friendly relations with those people and even intermarried with them. Why was that a problem? Okay. All right. It's not because God didn't want them to have happy families. It's because God knew that those people would be an adverse spiritual influence on the people of Israel. And they were. And this, you know, this begins a problem that the people of Israel struggle with their entire history to some degree or another. Sometimes it's better, sometimes it's worse, but it's always at least a potential problem. The presence of the Canaanite peoples and pagan influences that they represented, and so in, you know, sometimes, particularly in the divided kingdom, sometimes in the reigns of certain kings, it'll even talk about the high places being rebuilt. Or a good king comes along and he tears down the high places, and then another king comes along and he builds them back again. It's just a constant problem that has its roots in their failure to drive the people out completely. And in fact, when they initially failed to do that, God essentially said to them in the book of Joshua, all right, I'm going to leave those people there and I'm going to make it harder for you to drive them out because I'm going to put you to the test. And see, you know, see how badly you want to accomplish this. They were a thorn in their side. They were a stumbling block, really, is the term God usually uses. Shane. Right. Right. Sure. That's one of the things. They started looking around not only at the nations that were outside their borders, but at the Canaanite tribes that still lived in the land of Canaan. They've got kings who ruled as emissaries of the divine. That was kind of the concept. Hey, that looks good to us. And when they come to Samuel, many years after the book of Numbers, make us a king to judge us like all the nations. And Samuel warned them of all the hardships that were going to accompany that, but God permitted it to be so. And while they had some good kings, and a lot of problematic kings, more of those than the good kind, I would say. Particularly after the kingdom divided, you had north and south. So a lot of problems flow from their failure to keep this directive. And here's what God says. In verse 55, if they did not drive out the inhabitants, then it will come about that those whom you let remain of them will be like thorns in your eyes and like pricks in your sides, and they will trouble you in the land in which you live. And just as I plan to do to them, I will do to you. What's the threat there in that last statement in verse 56? Just as I plan to do to them, drive them out, that's what I'll do to you. Did God make good on that promise? Okay. Took a few hundred years for that to happen, but it happened. Yeah. All right. Moving on to chapter 35, we've already talked about this a little bit. Which of the tribes does not get an allotment of land like all the others? Okay, the tribe of Levi. You see the pattern here. Levi doesn't get numbered in the census either time in the book of Numbers. They are counted, but it's separate from the rest of the congregation. They are in essence the 13th tribe in that respect. They do not get an allotment of territory in the land. What do the Levites get as their inheritance? All right. They are given 48 cities distributed throughout the land of Israel, along with the immediately adjoining pasture land of those cities. This is, and remember when we talked about the things that happened in the year of Jubilee, there were special regulations for Levite cities because they were a special set of circumstances. Property in Levite cities, I mean, with regard to that. That's going to be the heritage of the Levites. They don't have a tribal territory. Okay? You've got the territory of Judah down in the south, the territory of, you know, of Issachar up in the north, and Zebulun and Dan way up there. There's no territory of Levi. There are 48 Levite cities throughout the land of Israel. And six of those cities in particular, we want to talk about just a little bit, and we're comparing Numbers 35 with Deuteronomy 19, which just covers a lot of the same ground. But these are all Levite cities. We know they're named at six of these Levite cities that are going to serve as what we call cities of refuge. Somebody tell me about just kind of summarize the purpose for which these six cities of refuge, there's three. Basically, they're evenly distributed. You have three on the east side of the Jordan, north, middle, and south. Three on the west side of the Jordan, north, middle, and south, roughly. South. What are they for, Chris? Okay. All right. Okay. So Chris mentioned the Avenger of Blood. Do you picture some, you know, guy in a black cloak, you know, the hood over his face, running around with it? Who's the Avenger of Blood that he refers to? Okay. Yeah, it was a family member of who had been killed. So what's Chris did a really good job of summarizing what these cities are about. What is this supposed to accomplish? Okay. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and that's exactly right. In our own laws, do we make a distinction between, say, premeditated murder and conduct that accidentally and unintentionally leads to someone's death? Sure we do. One we call first-degree murder, the other we typically call manslaughter, and there's a couple degrees in between there in our legal system. Well, in the administration of justice under the Mosaic Law, something similar inheres. And the cities of refuge are set up to provide an opportunity to make sure that a fair hearing is conducted in a case where someone has died, so that nobody is put to death for an accident, in essence, for killing that was not malicious and not intended. Faye made the observation, and this is kind of really fleshed out in verses 16 to 25. Guidelines are given for determining whether a person was guilty of murder and therefore subject to the death penalty, or guilty of manslaughter and therefore eligible to be protected in the city of refuge. So if you, in some circumstance, caused the death of another person, You could flee to this, to one of these cities of refuge. Then, you know, you obviously want to pick the nearest one, because the relatives of that dead person had a right of retribution. And you could go to that city of refuge, and as, you know, Faye pointed out, a hearing, you know, was to be conducted, and the, and God gives some guidelines for, you know, the determination. And if you were found to be guilty of murder, then that was that, because murder brought the death penalty under the law of Moses. If it was found to be an accidental set of circumstance, then you were not only allowed to, but required to remain in that city of refuge. Chris, until when? Okay. Until the death of the current high priest. So if you're in that situation, you would really hope that the high priest at that time was really old and in bad health, right? No. Because you know, that could potentially be a long, long time. If you left the city of refuge before the terms, before the high priest died, what could happen? Okay, what very likely would happen is that that avenger of blood would seek your life. Notice also in verses 30 and 31, I didn't ask you a question about this, but God provides, there's no buying your way out of this either way. Verse 30 of chapter 35, if anyone kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death at the evidence of witnesses, but no person shall be put to death on the testimony of one witness. Moreover, you shall not, it's verses 31 and 32 I meant to read, sorry. Verse 31, you shall not take ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death. Have we seen a lot of circumstances under the law of Moses where a sin or a crime against someone, which, you know, a lot of overlap between those things in the law, required you to pay restitution, for example, to pay a ransom, essentially? Sure. Okay. You couldn't do that in the case of murder. In the case of murder, there was no buying your way or paying a fine to get out of it. You were liable to the death penalty. Verse 32, you shall not take a ransom for him who has fled to his city of refuge that he may return to live in the land before the death of the priest. Hey, it's been a few years. You know, the priest was really young when I had to flee to the city of refuge, and I'm getting tired of being here in the city of refuge. Can I pay a fine or a ransom and leave early? No. That could not be done. So, you know, those were exceptions that, you know, you can probably, a lot of times when you read the law of Moses, you can see God anticipating what we so often do. Yeah, but what if this? We go exception hunting. We're really good at that, and God just heads that off at the pass here. What about verse 30? I read that, but in order for a person to be put to death for a crime, there were several. You know, there were several things under the law that bore the death penalty. Murder is the one that's the primary focus here. But in order for somebody to be put to death for a crime, what was necessary? Okay. All right. More than one, yeah. If anyone kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death at the evidence of witnesses. Okay. Plural. Testimony of two or three witnesses is what a couple of other scriptures confirm. Does that make good sense to you? Okay. In fact, in another place, God, you know, is specific. You don't put somebody to death on the testimony of a single witness. Why is that just good policy? Besides being, you know, I mean, I say anything God declares is good policy, but why is that something that just obviously makes sense to us, is what I'm trying to say. Okay, all right. You're a lot less likely to get false accusations that way. All right. You know, if it's on the testimony of one person, or one person could just make stuff up. Now, is it remote? You know, is there a possibility in any given situation that two or three people could conspire to lie? Sure, but that's a lot harder to make happen. So you have a built-in safeguard for those who may be accused in this kind of situation. Verse 33 gives a motivation for a lot of these things. You shall not pollute the land in which you are, for blood pollutes the land, and no expiation can be made for the land for the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it. You shall not defile the land in which you live, in the midst of which I dwell. For I am the Lord, I the Lord am dwelling in the midst of the sons of Israel. So there once again, remember when we talked about the not just the Sabbath days, but the Sabbath years in which crops were not sown and harvested. The land was given a rest. And we talked about the year of Jubilee, when in the seventh Sabbath year was followed by another Sabbath year with some special things. So, the land got a double rest. And God talked about the land having its Sabbaths and said, if you don't do this, I'll drive you from the land so that it will have its Sabbaths. Very often God speaks to the people as, in terms of the land on which they live, as if, almost as if it's a living thing that they can, that they can offend. He doesn't speak of it in those terms. But he speaks of it as something that is a very special possession that God is allowing them to live on and dwelling among them on. And if they treat it badly, and we're not talking about environmentalism here, we're talking about if they treat it badly by abusing the covenant God has made with them, they will forfeit the privilege of living in this land if they persist in that. And here he talks about polluting the land with blood. And that's not the only time that kind of language is used to describe murder. And God says the only thing that will expiate that is the blood of the guilty. All right. Anything else before we move on and talk about just a couple other things? Most of these things are at least somewhat familiar, just wanted to kind of go over them. Got one more thing in our workbook, and that's actually from the book of Deuteronomy, as we kind of close our study out. Deuteronomy is again a rehearsal of the things God has done for the people of Israel, and a rehearsal or restating of many of the elements of the covenant that God has made with the people of Israel. As they are preparing, just picture the people of Israel camped on the east side of the Jordan, and Moses is speaking to them about all these things as they are getting ready to cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan. And Moses isn't going to get to do that with them, but he's giving them final directives and reminders about the faithfulness of God and about their obligations to be faithful before they go in and possess the land. That's what Deuteronomy is all about. So here's Deuteronomy chapter 34 and verse 10, which says, in fact, whoever gets there first, just read it for us. Deuteronomy 34, verse 10. All right. All right. Since then, no prophet has arisen in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. And yet, let's compare that with something Moses says in Deuteronomy chapter 18. Let's read Deuteronomy 18 and verses 18 and 19 there. Deuteronomy 18, verses 18 and 19. Okay. Moses says, someday, as God has promised, he's going to raise up a prophet from among my countrymen like me and put his words in the mouth of that prophet and speak to the people, and if they don't listen, there will be a reckoning. And yet Deuteronomy 34 says, as yet, when the final edition of Deuteronomy is made after Moses dies, no prophet has arisen like Moses. Who is the prophet that Moses was talking about, and how do you know? Who ends up fulfilling that promise in Deuteronomy chapter 18? Okay, Jeff says Jesus. Do I hear a different answer from anyone? Okay, how do you know? What makes you say that Jesus is the fulfillment of it? Okay. In the Gospel of John in particular, there are a number of times when somebody will make a reference to the prophet. So when some of the Jewish leaders come out to John the Baptist and they're questioning him, who are you? Are you Elijah? No. Are you the Messiah? No. Are you the prophet? Oh, John doesn't elaborate on what they meant by that. He doesn't really have to. When they talked about the prophet, they meant the prophet like Moses, that Moses all those years before had said would arise. You have again in chapter 6 and in chapter 7, people's saying about Jesus, I wonder if this guy's the prophet. Now, some of them equated the prophet with the Messiah. Some of them equated the prophet with an additional figure who might come along in the Messianic age and accompany the kingly Messiah. There were a couple of three different views of that among the Jews. They weren't monolithic in their opinion on that. But they had it, they had the understanding that at some point, presumably in the Messianic age, that prophet that Moses was talking about was going to arise. Were they right about that, by the way? Yeah, they were. Okay. They just didn't recognize him when he was right in front of them. Well, some did. Some did. Yeah, that's right. That's right. And here is another even clearer piece of evidence. It's in Acts chapter 3. This is Peter's sermon that nobody ever pays attention to, because we always focus on the one in Acts 2. This is the sermon that Peter and John preach in Acts 3 after they heal the lame man in the temple. Chapter 3 of Acts, verse 19, therefore repent and return so that your sins may be wiped away, in order that times of refreshing may come from the presence of the Lord, that he may send Jesus the Christ appointed for you, whom heaven must receive until the period of the restoration of all things, about which God spoke through the mouths of his holy prophets. Verse 22, Moses said, the Lord God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren. To him you shall give heed in everything he says to you, and it will be that every soul that does not heed that prophet shall be utterly destroyed from among the people. Peter doesn't spell it out until he gets to verse 26. For you first God raised up his servant and sent him to bless you by turning every one of you from your wicked ways. Here's Peter, without question, identifying Jesus as the prophet Moses, the ultimate fulfillment of that promise that Moses made. So there's our last and maybe most important Old Testament, New Testament connection to the things we've been studying about. Moses himself told the people of Israel, someday a greater Moses is coming. Hebrews talks about that as well, and other passages in the New Testament. Well, that's all we have time for. Thanks for going with me on this journey through these books. I know these books don't get studied a lot, especially the elements of the law that we looked at. Hopefully by making some connections to the gospel, we've gained a deeper appreciation for those things. Once more, pick up, if you haven't done it already, pick up a workbook for next quarter, which we will begin Sunday. Those are back in the back, or you can download it from the website. Luke chapter 1 is where we'll be beginning Sunday morning.